As you know, when I was in college, I pursued a beautiful young lady. Woo! Everyone told me she was out of my league. Everyone. They're like, there's not a chance you are ever going to get her. And I'm one of those stubborn people like most of you. I think I attract all the stubborn people. Like if you tell me I can't do something, chances are I'm going to do it just to spite you, just for the fun of it. And it's one of those things. Have you ever like pursued someone? And it's one of those, it's a tricky balancing act. You know, on one hand, there are times that you really should give up. She's really not that interested in you. She doesn't like you. She doesn't care about you. Move on to something else. And then there's others where you're like, no, I think there's something there. I need to keep pursuing it. And the same thing with God, right? Have you ever gotten something and you're like, God, I think he is leading me to do something. And I've tried and I've tried and I've tried and I keep failing and I keep failing and I keep failing. You talk to your Christian friends and they finally look at you and say, I think God's trying to tell you something. Time to exit stage left. And then there's others that might say, no, 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 you've got to persevere. You've got to fight through this because God's given you something. You got to keep going. Well, which one is it? When is it? When should we give up and when should we persevere? And that's in a lot of things in life. People tell me I'm in this job. I hate my job. My job stinks. This is terrible. And yet there might be another job, but should I pursue it? Should I not? You know, what is God telling me? And we always have this difficulty. Should I continue to pursue something even when the door keeps getting shut or I'm not too sure if I got a clear pathway versus, well, I've got this inner drive. It is a difficult thing. This is the exact same thing that happened to the Israelite nation in Judges chapter 20. I entitled this, When God Lets You Down, because I think we've all experienced it. I know years ago, a lady comes to me, beautiful woman by the name of Corwin Arthurs, and she comes to me and she says, I think we need to start a homeless ministry. And of course, she didn't just come alone. She grabbed Lynn Moore. And Lynn comes, and then they grab another person, Tara Ivy, and they're like, I think we should start this homeless ministry where we feed people on Wednesday nights. I'm like, hey, I'm all for it. I think this could be a good idea. This would be great. You know, you have the permission, lots of announcements, got the message out to the homeless that were there in the area, come on Wednesday nights, and it was spectacular. That first night, do you know how many homeless people showed up? Zero. None. This is no, am I right? This is no, there was no one. And I remember after, because people brought spaghetti dishes and people brought food and there's all these people sitting around and there is no one there. Would that have maybe discouraged you? Maybe you would have said, maybe God is not calling us to start a homeless ministry. It went through my brain. I don't know if it went through your brain, Lynn. I don't think it went through Corwin. She's about as stubborn as I am. I know Lynn is too. And they're like, nope, we're doing this next week. I'm like, are you crazy? We're going to do. I'm like, hey, I'm behind you. If this is what you believe God is calling you to do, then you need to do it. And the next week, there were dozens. And then from there, years and years later, this is what we do quite frequently on Sunday nights and Wednesday nights. It's difficult when God calls you to do something and then you experience what we will label as failure and you feel like you must re-examine God's call. Happens all the time. Happens in jobs, schools, marriages. Let's see how the Israelite nation dealt with this. And if you're ever like, well, like, give me some practical advice on what should I do? Well, here we go. Judges 20 actually has some pretty cool advice to help us in this particular thing. All right. Quick recap. Judges 19, Levite, a priest, pastor, takes a concubine, really shouldn't have been taking a concubine, takes a concubine, goes down, gets cornered by a bunch of unsavory people, as the text says, they wish to know the Levite. They wish to to rape him, and they say no, but here, have the concubine instead. She gets brutalized all night. She dies. The Levite, he's a really caring kind of guy, kicks her, says, come on, get up. She's dead, puts him on the donkey, goes back home, chops her into 12 pieces, and males are all over the place. Everyone is freaking out because nothing like this has been done. And of course, what hasn't been done? Yeah, this idea that this town is corrupt and that priests are chopping up dead women and mailing them all over the place. This is pretty crazy. Verse 1, though, again, is so helpful. All the Israelites from Dan to Beersheba and from the land of Gilead came out as one man and assembled before the Lord in Mizpah. Mizpah was a place where they always went to reestablish the covenant. This was their reminder of what has God said. Today's Christian might say we should gather as one people in the church. We should gather as one people under the cross, under the death and resurrection of Christ, so that we may make decisions. And that's what's happening here. When there is a sin issue, we go back to Jesus. When there is a decision issue, we go back to Jesus. When there is a leadership issue, we go back to Jesus. That's kind of the idea. So they all gather, which is really crazy, that all through the book of Judges, we have people raised up for these special events, and every time they make a call out, let's gather together, no one shows up. But all of a sudden, you chop up a dead girl, you mail her all over the place. That seems to arouse everyone's curiosity, and it's enough to cause them to come. And this is true. This is us. Sometimes we stay in our lethargy until something big happens, until we're woken up like that's a really big thing. That's what's happening here. They all gather. Verse 2, the leaders of all the places of the tribes of Israel took their place in the assembly of the people of God. 400,000 soldiers armed with the sword. They came out en masse. They know that something is about to happen, and this is the largest assembled army throughout the book of Judges. No other judge was able to do it, but this nameless Levite, this nameless priest succeeds in it. Incredible. Verse 3, the Benjamites heard that the Israelites had gone up to Mizpah because not everyone showed up. There was one tribe that didn't, and that was Benjamin, because where did this heinous act take place? It was in the tribe of Benjamin. It was in one of those towns. So then the Israelites said, tell us how this awful thing happened. So the priest is actually brought forward. He is going to be the testimony. He is going to share his account of the story. And as we read the story, his version of it, please tell me how accurate Ryan Locke, this nameless priest, is in his version of events. I'm so glad you laughed at that. It is one of those things, like I'm reading this, like, this is Ryan Lochte all over. Do y'all know, are y'all with me on the Ryan Lochte? Or like some of you are like, no? No. Ryan Lochte, he's a swimmer in Rio. He says that he was robbed at gunpoint. A guy puts a gun to his forehead. And then the follow-up is, he made most of it up. He was drunk, he was a vandal, security guard came over, said, what are you doing, you've got to pay for that. He considered himself robbed because someone at gunpoint took his money, so that's how he called it robbed, but it really wasn't. And then some people lied on the police thing, so one swimmer got detained for and had to pay 11. So it's interesting, because then I saw, did you see it last night? The Lochte interview, and the whole time he's like, I think I'm an idiot. Yes, you are. Just tell the truth. Okay, so this is Ryan Lochte right here. This is hilarious. Okay, so the Levite, the husband of the murdered woman, said, I and my concubine, we came to Gibeah in Benjamin to spend the night. And during the night, and this is a mistranslation. If you want to cross it out, you can. He doesn't actually say the men of Gibeah. He says the leaders of Gibeah. So he changes a key detail in it. He's saying this isn't just the common folk. This was the leadership of the town. What was that? Do you have NIV 2011? Okay, I have 1984. So, okay, that's good that NIV 2011 added it in, because it's actually, I'm surprised 1984 didn't add that detail in. During the night, the leadership of Gibeah came after me and surrounded the house intending to kill me. Did they come to the house intending to kill him? No, I mean, it was still bad. They were coming to rape him. And it very well could be that he feared that this was going to end in death. This is the same, the Ryan Lochte. Yes, if someone comes to you with a gun and you can't understand them and they want money, it may feel like, but he embellishes and says, they came to kill me. They raped my concubine and she died. A couple, what's probably one of the biggest details that was left out there? Yeah, he not only, well, the dad suggested, and then it came time for the thing, and what does he do? Pushes her out the door and, like, shuts the door quickly. Lock it, man, dude. And then she does. So she's offered up kind of as sacrifice, and he doesn't mention that. Huh. They raped my concubine and she died. I took my concubine, cut her into pieces, and sent one piece to each region of Israel's inheritance because they committed this lewd and disgraceful act in Israel. Now, all you Israelites, speak up and give your verdict. And this is one of those really important lessons, because one of the laws in Deuteronomy says that if there's these accusations, especially when it comes to Israelite to Israelite, the most important thing you should do, investigate the matter. Because you may find out details that were actually not very accurate. Much like Ryan Lochte, after everything was investigated, his story didn't quite hold up. The story of the three swimmers didn't hold up. This happens all the time. I have come to the conclusion that most of us are embellishers, and when we give an account of something, we try to put ourselves in the best possible light. This is the reason why sometimes a guy comes to me, Pastor Manning, I'm having troubles in my marriage. My wife, she does this, she does this, she does this, she does this. And I, as a good pastor, will sit there and I'll listen. I'll go, okay, uh-huh, all right, okay, uh-huh. And I know that what he's trying to do at that point is to do what? He's swaying, trying to sway me so that I'm now on his side. And I have learned this most important thing is I don't believe any of you. I don't. I wait because I know that he's going to go home and wife's going to be like, where were you at? And he's like, I went and saw Pastor Manning. And you know what happens? 10 minutes later, ring, ring. Pastor Manning, can I come in for a visit? I need some counsel. Oh, and it's the wife. And then the wife comes in and then I get to hear the other side of the story. Very fascinating. This happens frequently. I think that sometimes we get caught up in emotion when we hear something and there is this outcry and we haven't taken the time even to investigate anything. I know that when the Ryan Lochte thing hit, all of America rose as one. Curse you, Rio! Everyone was upset. And now all of a sudden, everyone's like, curse you, Lochte, because we found out more of the information. We do this with our kids, right? We found out our kid got busted for cheating on a test. And we come down and we're like, forget it. No, I don't want to hear the other side of the story. I'm coming against you with the full force of the law. The parental law is going to destroy you. And we didn't find out that our child actually wasn't the one cheating on the test. They were the ones being cheated off of. But the teacher doesn't know who's doing what. So guess what? Both of them busted. Would that change how we treat things? Would that change maybe how we react? I mean, is it still an appropriate thing to do? No, but we might stop and maybe temper our actions. Your parents forget to pick you up after water polo practice. Just drive yourself home, kid. I just don't care. No, I'm just kidding. Your parents, and you are angry. And as all the other kids are being picked up for practice, there you are sitting there and you're steaming. You're like, man, I talked to them. I've texted them. I can't believe they're not here. I am so angry. And we get ourselves emotionally worked up. And then we come to find out our parents were in a terrible car accident and died. Okay, that was extreme. Yeah. I don't know if that. Now, if that actually happened, would we not temper it? Like, okay, maybe we should. But this happens all the time. This is, I think, something really important because the Israelites are about to engage in an activity that if they knew the whole story, maybe they would change their actions. And it's from Scripture. That's the reason why God, in Deuteronomy, says, if accusations are made, if something happens and you don't like it, the first thing you should do is go and ask. First thing you do is investigate. You don't like what your spouse did? Maybe you should ask her about it. You think your husband's an idiot? Why don't you go ask? He's probably an idiot, but go and at least find out that maybe there's some extenuating circumstances. Yellen? Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah, and it's the same thing when I have counseling situations. I have never, ever, ever, ever found, let's say the girl is upset at the guy. We'll switch the roles. Girl's upset at the guy. I've never found it when it's 100% the guy's fault. It comes close at times, don't get me wrong. But with most things that happen in marriages, I can usually find a lot of mistakes that the girl has made. Again, it's not to excuse any action, but I found when someone comes to me and wants to sway me to one side, the harder they try to sway me to one side, the more I'm convinced there's more to this story that I have not heard yet. And I think that's how we should make sure that when we do that with our friends, right? Have you ever been in a group of friends and one person starts talking smack about one friend and is trying to create this bubble to destroy someone and to isolate them? Chances are there's more to this story than you could imagine. Yeah?
I can't understand why you felt the
story. See, and that's the problem. Yeah, if we talk about the Ryan Lochte issue, if you just wouldn't have said anything, the whole thing would have blown over. You wouldn't be suspended. Your friend wouldn't have had to pay $11,000 to get out of the country. Friends wouldn't have been pulled off a plane. It wouldn't have been news at all. It's news because you lie. And that's the thing. And it's interesting because I don't think it's all about lying. Because I don't think, if I say, don't lie, you're all like, yeah, don't lie. How about don't embellish the truth to the point where you look like the victim? And that's what it got. The interview last night was very interesting. Matt Lauer was like, when this all started, you sounded like the victim, but it sounds like you're more like the vandal. And he was like, no, I had a gun pointed at. I'm like, you're the vandal. Just admit it. We do this. We make ourselves sound better. All right, so unknown priest gives this thing. In verse 8, all of the people rose as one man saying, none of us will go home. No, not one of us will return to his house. But now this is what we will do in Gibeah. We'll go up against it as the lot directs. So they're saying that I am now disturbed to the point that something should happen. And is there times when we hear of evil and we need to address that? Yeah. You know, I threw something out last week, and I was really thankful for the princes to ask me, because I threw out the statement about how slavery is still very much alive, and especially the concept of forced sex slavery that's all over. It is very much an underground hidden sin. We don't talk about it, because if you heard about it, I think you would be sick to your stomach, and maybe you would even rise as one people saying, we need to stop this. But I think that that's maybe what needs to happen. Sometimes we need to confront evil. We need to confront it appropriately. We need to know who are the good guys, who are the bad guys. We don't demonize and victimize the females and the young men who have been sold in there. We place the blame on the proper people. And we're part of the problem, because we have our head in the sand. So part of the issue is us. So they rose, they said, we're going to do this. We're going to go up against as the lot directs. Verse 12, 10, we'll take 10 men out of every 100 from all the tribes of Israel, and 100 from every 1,000, and 1,000 from every 10,000 to get provisions for the army. So like, we're going to take 10%, we're going to go against this town, we're going to take it out. Then when the army arrives at Gibeah and Benjamin, it can give them what they deserve for all the vileness done in Israel. So all the men of Israel got together and united as one man against the city. This is fascinating because already through the book of Judges, how good are the other tribes? Not very good. I mean, Dan, what's the problem with Dan? Dan has an issue. Dan loves to set up false idols and worship false gods, but no one's saying anything about that. There's sin that's riddled all through it. People are in constant disobedience, but the one thing that's going to get them all worked up is this rape and murder of this young lady. Please, don't misunderstand, is what they did wrong and bad. Yes, but sometimes we focus, again, this was that sermon, we focus so much on the external that we forget that there is lots of other sin to go around. And I think that's another thing, too, that will help us. When we are those people that are spinning stories and going exaggeration, we need to ask ourselves, are we just as guilty as the other person? When your spouse offends you, ask yourself the question, am I just as guilty? Have I done the same thing? Am I also culpable in this as well? And I think that might cause you to temper your actions and reactions against your spouse. Before you fly off the handle at your friend because of what they've done to you, ask yourself the question, have I done the same thing at times? So they go, they're upset, they're going to take out Benjamin. Thankfully, at least there's this concept that there's their conscience is not so seared against sin that they're not going to act. So verse 11, all the men of Israel got together, united as one man against the city. The tribes of Israel sent men throughout the tribe of Benjamin saying, what about this awful crime that was committed among you? Now surrender those wicked men of Gibeah so that we may put them to death and purge the evil from Israel. And this is usually what happens when we're offended. We go on the warpath and try to destroy as much as possible instead of doing what Deuteronomy says, which is, why don't you investigate the matter and find out more information before you crucify your spouse or crucify your kids or destroy your parents? Why don't you ask them? They don't do that. They come and they're like, what have you done? We are going to kill you all. Okay, if you're Benjamin, what do you do? Oh my gosh, thank you so much for pointing out the sin in our land. You know what? You're right. I think I repent, and I'm going to turn over these evil people that have done this, and thank you for the correction. Yeah, it never works. I've always, one of these days, I've always wanted to try it, you know, with Heather. She'll know because I test theories out on her all the time. When I do something really stupid, which is quite frequently, and then she comes at me and she's like, nah, 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 nah. I really would love to see if I could have the composure to go, huh, that's a good point. Because I know this, whenever I'm getting yelled at, what is my reaction? Defense, and I'm going to fight back. Right? And also, don't you hate it when you have done something really stupid and wrong and you get attacked and then you start defending your indefensible position? Does Benjamin have a leg to stand on? No, they've done some really bad things, but because of this frontal assault, it doesn't actually fix things. We just need to watch this. So they're like, give them up! But the Benjamites would not listen to their fellow Israelites. From their towns, they came together at Gibeah to fight against the Israelites. At once, the Benjamites mobilized 26,000 swordsmen from their town. So this is going to be a great fight. 26,000 against 400,000. This is going to be great. Benjamin, you're outnumbered. This is not going to work for you, my friend. But they, you know, the interesting thing is the Benjamites don't just have 26,000. What do they also have? In addition to 700 chosen men from those living in Gibeah, among all those soldiers, there were 700 chosen men who were left-handed. I thought left-handed people were, like, useless, but apparently there's a biblical... Oh, I'm just kidding. I love my left-handed people. A little weird, a little off. We've talked about left-handed people back in Ehud's day. 700 left-handers, each of whom could sling a stone at a hair and not miss. marksmen with a sling that were left-handers. So these were like the elite. This was the special ops. Yeah, the special left-handed ops that were would do. So these slow. Yeah, this was a SWAT team. Yeah, so they could. Yeah, and this is not sling like a wrist rocket, right? You know, yeah, this was the shoot, David and Goliath left-handed. See, I can't even do it left-handed. You know, you circle, whop, bam. Yeah, I would totally, yeah. That's how they found the stuff. Like, if you could do it once and it worked, they're like, we'll practice with you. But if you're like, whack, you know, sorry, dude, you are out. Take your right-handed self out of here. 700 left-handers. And verse 17, Israel, apart from Benjamin, mustered 400,000 swordsmen, all of them fighting men. We already heard that early on. Then the Israelites went up to Bethel and inquired of God. Oh, my goodness. Finally, I wonder about the alternate universe if they would have gone up to talk to God first. Would that change anything? Yeah, you're fighting with your spouse. What if the first thing you did was pray? There was this secretary that I worked with at a previous church, and she drove me nuts because we would be in a either a staff meeting or it might be elders or council, and things would start getting heated. And you know what she said all the time? Just bugged me to no end. When she started feeling the tension building, she'd be like, I think we should pray. And I'm like, no. Because if I pray for this person, I'm going to end up like liking them. I want God to smite them with the sword and maybe a little sulfur along with it. I hate what's going on. And sure enough, every single time we prayed, guess what happened? We kind of settled down. I know that this is a unique thought of praying before we get upset. Praying, you know, we usually like to go off the handle first, and then we find out stuff later. Have you ever noticed that every time you go off the handle with bad information and without praying, what do you end up always having to do? You always have to apologize at the end of the day, like, oh, man, yeah, I should have. Because I do that, too. I have great righteous indignation, let me tell you. You can ask my children, you can ask my wife, man. I can just go off, and I can smite you with the power of the Lord. And I always have to apologize afterwards, like, I'm sorry. So, but I will say this, at least they went, right? At least they went and asked. Like, if you're going to stay stubborn, then you're going to be, at least they finally go, maybe we should talk to God. I'm sure this lady was back there. Maybe we should talk to God. Okay, fine. So they go up. Where am I at? 18. Israelites went up and inquired of God. I love their inquiry. It's the best inquiry ever. They said, who of us shall go first to fight against the Benjamites? What do they not ask? Should we do this, God? Like, I'm really angry, and I want to kill these people because they're bad. Who should go first? Like, me? Like, me? Can maybe I? Like, I'll swing my sword hard, man. I'll mow them down. I would, you know, they ask first and foremost, who's going to, yeah. Instead of asking, should we, they said, we've already decided this, God, and now that we've decided our plan, it's time for you to get on board with our decisions. Right? Yeah, Alex? Oh, yeah, there are no good. Yeah, when you talk about this Israelite nation, they're all like sinner against sinner. And I found that when you start by acknowledging your own sin, you just might not attack so hard. Yeah, oh, it's very interesting. You're going to love what God does. This is brilliant. Yeah, Sam. Right, yeah, like when we pray, we always want to pray, you know, the way that's going to look good for us.
Like if they had asked, like, how badly are we going to kill the enemy instead of...
Yeah, I would love it because we do this too. Lord, please turn the heart of Heather. She is just really stubborn right now. And Lord, I'm trying to work with... This is just an example. I've never prayed this. Never, Lord. She is obviously in the wrong. Lord, help me to be a patient and caring man. What would be a better prayer? Lord, What do I need to do? I am obviously in need of my own correction. Lord, what's going on? In all of this, you are teaching me something, and I need to learn something. Help me to do this correctly, Lord. If there is sin in my heart that I am not aware of, that maybe she's trying to point out, and I'm just blind to see, Lord, help me see it. Open my eyes so I can maybe face this. Yeah, it's a totally different mindset. We love to pray so that we get the answer we want. So it's, yeah, I love God, because God, I love God. That's a great say. I should say it. I love God. I love how he acts. I think I could be God at times, because this is how I would have acted. Other times, he's way too gracious, but this is fantastic. So they say, who should go up and fight against the Benjamites? The Lord replied, Judah shall go first, which is, I'm not going to spend too much time on it. The very beginning, when they entered the land and were about to conquer it, guess what they did? They went to God and said, who goes first? And guess who he said? Judah goes first. There's something cool about Judah. Yeah. So Judah shall go first. I love it because God does not answer the question that really should be asked. Because if I were God, I probably would have said something like, wrong question, try again, you idiots. But no, God's like, you should go first. Judah? Yeah, let's go for Judah. Yeah, they're stubborn. 19, the next morning the Israelites got up and pitched camp near Gibeah. The men of Israel went out to fight the Benjamites and took up battle positions against them at Gibeah. The Benjamites came out of Gibeah and cut down 22,000 Israelites on the battlefield that day. 22,000 die from the good guys, I guess. I don't, you know, the Israelites that have come for 22,000. And the inference, though it doesn't say it, but the inference is there was very little or no casualties on Benjamin's side. There's your answer. Verse 22, but the men of Israel encouraged one another and again took up their positions where they had stationed themselves on the first day. Out of curiosity, what would you have done if you were the Israelites at that point? Lord, who should go up? Judah. Okay. You die, and then you come back. Would you maybe start thinking, maybe there's something more to this? Is this really where God is leading me? This is where I think there starts to creep in the doubt. What happens when God fails you? God told you to do this. You do it. It doesn't work. Second time's a charm. Right, well, let's see what he says in number two. Number two, the 23, the Israelites went up and wept before the Lord until evening. I think they're getting closer. I think they're starting because I think there was a reason why they failed the first time. You know, where was the start? When you go against someone, is it pleasant when people get punished? I know that we have a sense of justice and righteousness, but when God sees someone killed, is he rejoicing? Is he up there like, man, finally got that guy, man. I've been trying to squash him like a bug for years. No, God's up there weeping. When we confront sin, do we confront sin with righteous indignation? Or do we confront sin with tears streaming down our cheeks? Like, I don't want to do this. This is not good, but I have to because this is important. So they weeping until evening, and they inquired of the Lord. Good answer. They said, shall we go up again to battle against the Benjamites, our brothers? You could start to hear the softening of the language, because now it's not the Benjamites, those evil rapists. These are the Benjamites, our brothers. But they ask God point blank, should we go and do this? God's answer, go up against them. Okay, so now it's undeniable. The first question, maybe not the best question. Second, they go point blank, God, should we attack them? And God says, yes, do it. 24, then the Israelites drew near to Benjamin the second day. This time when the Benjamites came out from Gibeah to oppose them, they cut down another 18,000 Israelites, all of them armed with swords. God asked them to do it, and they failed. Man, this is hard. It happens all the time. God may ask you to befriend that person who has no friends. And so you, Lord, I don't know if I can do this, but I will. I don't know how this is going to react with all my other friends, but I feel like this is what you want. I go and do it, and that person just destroys you. You get the divorce papers. You were certain that God wanted you to marry that person. And then it all falls apart and God fails you. And you wonder, was this right? You want to start a ministry, but you can't seem to get anywhere. And you start second guessing everything. Is this what I should be doing? You choose a college and you go there. And it's not working out. You're getting roadblock after roadblock and bad thing after bad thing. And you have people saying, maybe this was the bad choice. And you're like, man, but I think God wants us to. Is it true that God calls us to failure? I guess it depends upon how you define failure. I think that there are many a time. And I usually use Ezekiel as the greatest example. In Ezekiel chapter 3, it's such a brilliant thing. God comes to Ezekiel and says, Ezekiel, I'm going to call you to a people. These are not foreigners. These are not people with a strange dialect or language. These are going to be your own Israelite brothers. And when you go and talk to them about me, guess what's going to happen? They aren't going to listen. They're going to eventually hate you. They're going to want to kill you. And everything you do to preach to them is not going to succeed. And by maybe our worldly standards, we would say, that was a failure. But with God, is anything really a failure? Is God doing other things? Yeah. Yeah. Right, yeah. There could be a timing issue. There could be a heart issue, which is what I think is happening in this particular thing. The Israelites needed to not be so righteously indignant against the sin of someone else because they hadn't even looked at their own sin, for heaven's sake. These are times, yeah, I think that God calls us to worldly failure because there's going to be something else that he's going to be working on. Is it fun to do it? No. Let me tell you, that first time we had that homeless ministry and no one showed up, I'm like, oh, that hurts. But let me tell you, they're being changed. I think through this, what God is doing is he has the thing against the Benjamites, against Gibeon, the sin that they've committed, but he can't allow a righteously indignant people to just come and destroy them or else something bad will happen. I think that with a lot of things. Sometimes we get called to something, and it may not succeed the way we want to, but God is doing something behind the scenes that we may not know about. Ellen? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Right. And it's so easy to not have the humility. It's so easy to say, Lord, I'm so glad I'm helping the homeless. Please bless me because I'm helping. It's so easy to, instead of saying, Lord, I am a nobody, I am a nothing, I simply serve you. Now God can use that. Wow. All right, so they lose again. I love it. When you lose. A great title of a sermon. God wants you to lose. Isn't that great encouragement? Like, yay! Okay. Verse 26, and the Israelites, all the people went up to Bethel, and there they sat weeping before the Lord. Ooh, they go further. They fasted that day until evening. They presented burnt offerings, because let me tell you, it's really important to eat meat, talking to God. Fellowship offerings to the Lord. The Israelites inquired of the Lord. In those days, the Ark of the Covenant of God was there with Phinehas, son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, ministering before it. So the idea This wasn't a half-hearted like inquiry. They really seriously asked the question, is this what we should be doing? And and when you fast, why do you fast? Find out what God's will is, and it's to shake you up, it's to focus, it gets you out of your routine, because it's so easy when you pray and seek God's will to just keep doing the same thing. And fasting is also a sign of humility. Lord, I don't know if this is right. Lord, we come to you, whatever you want. And when we start saying, thy will be done instead of my awesome, cool will that I've decided is good, be done. So they asked, shall we go, this is a better question, shall we go up again to battle with the Benjamin, our brother, or not? They actually say, Lord, should we do this? Or maybe we shouldn't do this, God. Maybe this is not the right answer. Yeah, we finally, instead of praying, Lord, we're going to do this, please bless us. They're like, Lord, what do you want? And interestingly enough, the Lord said, go, for tomorrow I'll give them into your hands. So now we got a promise along with it, right? Now we got a promise. Israel set an ambush around Gibeah. I love this. They actually pull a page out of the playbook of Joshua. And Israel set up an ambush around Gibeah. They went up to the Benjamites on the third day, took up positions against Gibeah as they had done before. The Benjamites came out to meet them. They're like, yes. Could you imagine if you're a Benjamite? You totally slaughter them twice, and then they're coming back. You're like, time for another whooping. All right, this is going to be awesome. They come out, and you just must like, hey, guys, worked before. Let's do it again. Let's go out. And interestingly enough, again, Benjamin isn't thinking of themselves. Maybe I've got something I should look at. They don't. Benjamites come out to meet them and were drawn away from the city. They begin to inflict casualties on the Israelites as before, and I'm sure the Israelites are like, are you kidding me? We're dying again. This is not good. So that about 30 men fell in the open field and on the roads, the one leading to Bethel and the other to Gibeah. So they go to engage them. The Benjamites come out. What they do is they start like a retreat pattern, and they start going backwards. And of course, if you're the Benjamites, what do you do? You're like, oh, we got these people on the run. We're going to keep moving forward, keep moving forward. So about 30 are dead. While the Benjamites were saying, we're defeating them as before, the Israelites were saying, let's retreat and draw them away from the city to the roads. All the men of Israel moved from their places and took up positions about Tamar. And the Israelite ambush charged out of its place on the west of Gibeah. Then 10,000 of Israel's finest men made a frontal attack on Gibeah. The fighting was so heavy that the Benjamites did not realize how near disaster was. So they draw them all out, and once they draw them out, 10,000 people snuck in from the back, and where'd they go? Straight into the city, to Gibeah. And it's pretty simple, because is Gibeah defended now? No, they're toast. They're toast. This is why you don't. People tell me I'm not a good strategist, but, works in black ops. Call of Duty. I don't even play Call of Duty. Yeah. You do two fronts here. The Lord defeated, verse 35, the Lord defeated Benjamin before Israel, and on that day the Israelites struck down 25,000 Benjamites, all armed with swords. Then the Benjamites saw that they were beaten. Now the men of Israel had given way before Benjamin because they'd relied on the ambush they'd sent near Gibeah. The men who'd been in an ambush made a sudden dash into Gibeah, spread out, and put the whole city to the sword. So they destroyed the city. The men of Israel had arranged with the ambush that they should send up a great cloud of smoke from the city, and then the men of Israel would turn in the battle. So, like, we're going to keep withdrawing from the battle until we see smoke coming up from Gibeah, knowing that the town is destroyed, and then what are they going to do? They're going to turn and fight. Hold on a second, then. The Benjamites had begun to inflict casualty on the men of Israel, about 30, and they said, we're defeating them as in the first battle. But when the column of smoke began to rise from the city, the Benjamites turned and saw the smoke of the whole city going up in the sky. Then the men of Israel turned on them, and the men of Benjamin were terrified because they realized the disaster had come upon them. They're going to now lose the battle. They've been pulled out from the fight so far, and they're now surrounded. They surrounded the Benjamites, chased them, and easily overran them in the vicinity of Gibeah on the east. 18,000 Benjamites fell, all of them valiant fighters. As they turned and fled toward the desert to the rock of Rimmon, the Israelites cut down 5,000 men along the road, and they kept pressing after the Benjamites as far as Gidom and struck down 2,000 more. And on that day, 25,000 Benjamite swordsmen fell, all of them valiant fighters. But 600 men turned and fled into the desert to the rock of Rimmon, where they stayed 4 months. This is going to set up the next chapter. who are these people? And they escaped. So a bunch of them said, let's go hide in the rocks and escape. The men of Israel went back to Benjamin, put all the towns to the sword, including the animals and everything else they found. All the towns they came across, they set on fire. I am glad that God gave them defeat twice, because what would have happened if the first time they went up in their righteous anger and they had won? They would have thought it's all about them and how good they were. And here now, as they do this, they're like, this isn't, you know, it's this idea about sweet victory. We sometimes, when we get back at that person for that thing they did, we feel good for a moment, but then something in us feels slimy and gross because we realize we're no better. But when we temper our righteous anger with God's viewpoint, I think our heart changes. And I think this is something really important for us, that we don't walk into situations. We are not in a battle against the world to take everyone out. We are not fighting sin to the thing where we think that we are sinless. Let's just face it right here and now. We are all in the same boat. We have all sinned. Maybe we haven't done the exact things that Gibeah has done, but let me tell you, our heart is just as wicked. And we have those same issues that we deal with. And we all stand under God's grace. And we can all say, Lord, forgive me. I tried to do this for you, for your purpose, but I know I am not worthy of it. I stand in front of you, broken, humiliated, unable to do what you ask. But because you ask, because I want you to use me, Lord, I do this action. And when we come in it with that humility, you'll be amazed how fast things change. How they change for you and how you treat the people around you. Let's pray. Lord, I pray that you would give us your heart. We are in need of grace and forgiveness. Lord, some of us are struggling right now because we're fighting for things. Some of us are wondering, are we doing the right thing? Some of us are wondering if we're following your will appropriately, and it's really tough because we have failed. We have done things, and it hasn't worked out quite the way we thought they were going to work out. And when that happens, Lord, I pray that you would help us to see that maybe there's something else that we need to be looking at for ourselves. Maybe there's something that we need to have worked on inside of our heart. And I pray that you would give us your heart. For you, when you saw evil, did not see fit to just wipe everything out. When you saw evil, you decided to make a plan that included the death of Jesus, a plan that included forgiveness, a plan that included not wiping us out, but instead forgiving us in a way that we could never even imagine. And I can just imagine when Jesus was in the grave and it looked like the failure of the world had happened, when your plan didn't work the way we would have thought it would work, you came with this beautiful, unexpected twist. And because of Jesus' death and because of his resurrection, you gave us forgiveness. And we see the same